David Tennant becomes interviewer and picks his guest, who's a fellow Scot, best known for a comedy role which he turned down 3 times. Chain Reaction gets underway in a moment. Then at 7, there's some unwelcome news in The Bull in The Archers. First, though, let's look ahead to the weekend when we explore the price of peace.
As the 10th anniversary of the Good Friday Peace Agreement approaches, BBC Radio 4 begins a new 3-part series investigating how the Republican and Unionist deadlock was finally broken.
People really accepted that there was no alternative, because what all sides had to do was take risks with their supporters. What all sides had to do was change fundamental positions.
The Price of Peace begins on Sunday afternoon at 1:30.
And now on Radio 4, without a sonic screwdriver in sight, it's Chain Reaction.
Hello, and welcome to Chain Reaction. My name is David Tennant. Last time I was the interviewee, but today I am the interviewer. Which would be daunting if it weren't for the fact that my guest is such a wonderful, all-round, splendid chap. He is an actor and a director. He has been a regular on our TV screens for as long as I can remember. But back in the 90s, he became just about the most famous man in the country. He is also one of the finest, most generous and noblest people I know. He has been an inspiration to me, both personally and professionally. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Richard Wilson.
Hi, Dave. This is a strange place to meet, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just you, me, and 300 of our closest personal friends. So, thank you for coming along to Chain Reaction.
My pleasure.
Yeah. We are from quite similar backgrounds.
We are.
Albeit a few years apart, but we're geographically very similar. Renfrewshire, west of Scotland.
Renfrewshire, west of Scotland.
Greenock and Paisley.
Paisley, just next door to each other.
Oh, spitting distance.
We could have a good chat and just leave them out.
Yeah. I think that's the plan.
Yeah.
It's a particular type of upbringing, though, that kind of Scottish Presbyterian. Damn. Do you think that that particular type of upbringing is a help or a hindrance to a budding actor?
Gosh, that's a very
difficult
question.
We're straight in. We don't hang around here.
I thought this was going to be light-hearted banter.
No, no, no. No, if you had Catherine Tate, you'd have light-hearted banter, but you've got me.
Right. Well, you can answer that as well as I can. I mean, certainly when I was growing up, you didn't say you were going to be an actor.
No.
Because you
would
get a punch in the mouth.
Quite.
And told not to be a big Jesse.
Yeah.
And you had no theatre to see, by and large.
Nothing in Greenock at all.
Well, we had a theatre, but it was variety.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a great help, but big amateur movement in all the west of Scotland.
Which you got involved in, didn't you?
Which I was involved in, yes.
But do you think there's something about that west of Scotland kind of stoicism, that sort of who do you think you are kind ofness about it? Is that an enemy to creativity, do you think?
Yeah, probably.
Mm.
It took me a long time. You, being much younger, I had role models and more...
Well, like yourself?
Well, like myself. But I didn't go to RADA till I was 27 because I just didn't have the confidence to say... I'm going to be an actor. I really didn't know if I'd become an actor. But, no. Of course, now there's a whole tranche of actors from Greenock.
Is there?
Yes.
Who else is from Greenock?
Oh, gosh, I knew you'd say that. Well, Bill Brighton, the director, he came from Greenock.
Right, right.
And then there's that girl in the Hat programme.
Sure. We all know her.
What's it?
The Hat programme?
Yes.
Did she wear a hat?
There was a series about making hats... What's her name?
A drama series about... Where was the conflict?
In the pins going in.
So when you were growing up, what was your family like? Were they funny? Or were you the funny
my
one?
My mother was funny.
Was she?
My father was a wee bit dour.
Uh-huh.
But a very happy upbringing.
You weren't poor then?
Poor? Well, we never had a car, we never had a telephone, we didn't have a television until very late.
Is it true that you had a television? I found out so many things about you researching this. Is it true that you only got a TV because your dad won the pools?
Yes, he did.
Look at that.
My father won the pools. He won £400. My mother and father swore me to secrecy. You mustn't tell anyone that your father has won the pools.
Why? Was that seen as a bit common?
I think people would come begging.
Oh, I see.
Things
yeah,
like that.
Right.
And I remember very clearly, my father went to the bank and withdrew £100 out. And he came home and he put it in the kitchen table and we all sat and looked at it.
What a pile of money.
Oh, it was extraordinary. And then we were allowed to touch it. And out of that, we got a television and a gramophone and a new suite, I think.
Today's equivalent, that's going to be a good few £1,000.
I know. All right, I thought you'd have found that out, research-wise.
Yes. Was it a puritanical household? Was it a...
It was an interesting household. My mother never went to church, but my father did, and I was expected to. And I became an atheist when I was 17, which was very hard for my father.
But not presumably for your mother, who...
No, that was fine by her.
Teetotal?
Yes. My father used to drink on New Year's Eve and get sick every year because he just wasn't used to it. I can remember that quite clearly. Not a great point to make on the radio. I had started drinking by this time.
Right.
And... I remember my father greeting me one morning and saying, "You were a bit late last night, weren't you?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "You had a good time." I said, "Yes." He said, "Clearly, because you still got your collar and tie on." And I was in my pajamas with a stiff collar and tie, which I had been unable to get off in my drunken state.
Were you a self-conscious youth?
Oh, yes. Desperately.
Yeah.
I was very, very skinny and gawky. You know gawky.
I do know gawky.
Not that I'm suggesting in any way whatsoever that you get an ounce of gawkiness.
I'm no stranger to gawkiness.
But I was very gawky.
Yeah. I've seen pictures. You were really gawky. I mean, I thought...
You're supposed to say that.
I thought I was a skinny youth, but you were like a pipe cleaner.
I was... I actually used to pray to God to put some weight on.
Even after you stopped believing in him?
Yeah. I think that's right.
Or is that why you stopped believing in him?
Probably. Actually, he did reply eventually because I began to get rather fat later on.
No. When did you lose the pipe cleaner look?
I suppose when I started drinking, really.
Right.
When I came to London, I suppose.
But you knew you wanted to be an actor. You had that...
Yes.
It was a little secret wish. Or was it never going to happen?
It was pretty secret. It was never going to happen, yeah. I thought, really. But I remember having a fight with a boy once in the playground, and he was hitting me rather severely. And I said, "Just you watch it, I'm going to be an actor one day." As I said it, I thought, what a stupid thing. As if that would impress him in any way at all.
Did you just get punched all the harder?
Yes,
that?
I think so.
Yeah. Didn't you have an incident where you said, "I quite fancy being an actor," and somebody said, "You can't speak," or something?
Yes. Oh, yes, yeah, she's still alive, this woman. She'll probably hear this. She said, "What are you going to do with yourself, Wilson?" And I took up a huge amount of courage and said, "Please, miss, I think I'd like to be an actor." And she said, "Don't be stupid, boy, you can't speak." That's what I remember.
Yeah.
She says that's not true.
But did that haunt you?
Yes, of course. You know, the idea that I would ever do a voiceover in my life, I never dreamt that would happen.
So you left school and...
I left school and went into medical laboratory work.
How did you end up doing... Why? What?
Well, exactly. Very good question. Well, I was quite good at science.
Right.
And people thought I was a doctor. So there was a bit of theatre in there as well.
Well, because you'd stood about in a white coat.
I stood about in a white coat and I had a big 10cc syringe to plunge.
Here's another one. You were in a skiffle group.
I was in a skiffle group at the laboratory in Greenock, yes.
Right.
We had a skiffle group and I played a four-string banjo, I think.
Right.
Very badly.
How long has it been since you've played the banjo?
Oh, many, 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 many years.
Because we have got one.
Oh, my goodness sake, David. I was just a wee, wee thing.
Is this not the right type of banjo?
No. Is it yours?
There was limited research available.
Are you going to play it?
No, I was going to see if you could. I can't get out of the box. There you go.
Look at that.
That's a beautiful instrument.
That's a beautiful instrument.
I think that's got more strings than you just said.
Oh, God, it's so heavy as well. 1, 2, 3, 4. Is it in tune?
Is it in tune? No, it's in tune.
No, that bottom chord's slightly out, so I can't touch it.
Oh.
Well, that's a really dirty trick.
Yeah.
No wonder. He said to me, do you want to know what I'm going to ask you? And I said, no, that's all right. Little did I think he was going to produce a bloody banjo. What else are you going to do?
Wait till we get to the unicycles.
That's okay.
Yeah, sure. And then you went to national service.
Yeah, well, I was in the medical corps, fortunately. Yeah. I was non-combatant. I could only fire a rifle to protect my patient.
Wow. Did you have target practice, though?
Yes, we did. I was deaf for 3 days afterwards.
Were you any good?
No. No, no, no.
I'll leave the rifle backstage now.
But, yes, frightening, absolutely frightening. I remember 4th of October 1956. The date is emblazoned in my mind.
Because you were being sent off and...
Yes, I'd never been away from home on my own. I remember I met a fellow Glasgow lab tech who had been in for a week. And I've never been so envious of a man in my life because it meant he was going to get out a week before I did. And it was 2 years, and I'm talking about a week. Oh, it was awful.
And did it stay awful? You didn't enjoy yourself?
Oh, no, I did enjoy it. No, I enjoyed it eventually, yeah. I went to Singapore eventually, which was a wonderful experience.
What were you examining in the labs when you were on national service?
Well, lots of nasty things.
Yeah.
I think you might be referring to the tapeworm. People who had tapeworms, it was a very ghastly illness to have a tapeworm.
Sure.
Which went many, many feet inside you. And there was a little head called the scolex, which had about 4 suckers and 8 hooks that grabbed onto your intestine.
Mm.
So the treatment was to get rid of the head. So every now and again, they used to send me bedpans from a patient with miles of tapeworm for me, amongst all the other stuff, to find the scolex, which I had to do with a magnifying glass. And Singapore was a very humid country. That was one of the nastier jobs.
What would you do it with a fork?
I think a spatula.
Sure.
It's a proper name.
And a rubber glove, I'm hoping.
And a rubber glove and a mask, yes.
Yeah, yeah. How did you finally get the guts up to go to...
I met this girl, a student at a party, and I'd always poo-pooed drama schools as being something that sort of dangerously could take your talent away and stop your spontaneity. But she talked me into it in a sense and said, you can get a grant if you lived in London for a year. The LCC will give you a grant and pay your fees. So I applied to RADA and got in. And RADA was one of the few schools that took people over 25.
So were you the oldest in your year?
I was 27. No, I wasn't the oldest. I was so relieved when I got in to find people older. There was an Egyptian who was 41, which was great.
Right. And at this time, presumably, you're still talking with a broad Greenock accent.
Oh, yes. I mean, this
How time, broad was your accent?
I don't remember, but I know when I first came to London, I knew I'd have to say everything twice.
Right.
Because he wouldn't understand me the first time.
And presumably at the RADA, back in them days, they didn't like that.
No, they didn't try to make you lose your accent, but they tried to allow you to be able to speak in a understandable sort of English.
Yeah.
But I had a very good voice teacher, Clifford Turner, who found our class a bit of a strain. Because there was me and there was the Egyptian. there was a Texan and a South African. He was getting quite old and he was sitting there and he'd see us come in and go... But he did try and help me quite a lot.
Yeah. But you came straight out of drama school into work, didn't you?
I did, yes. The following week, I did a Dr. Finlay's casebook.
Right.
I got a job on the Monday.
So you left drama school, got a job on the Monday, and have you ever been employed since? Unemployed since?
Oh, yes. I mean, if I hadn't been employed since, we probably wouldn't be sitting here.
I meant to say unemployed, obviously, clearly.
Ah. But it wasn't some sort of insinuation. Of how did you manage it?
No, it seems to me from the outside that you've been pretty employed.
Well, I became a director, which helped as well,
having two hats. Yeah.
Fortunately, I was lucky not to have long spells.
But I remember as a kid, I must have been off school now and again, you know, with a cold or something. And I remember you on Crown Court.
Oh, Crown Court.
Which was a daytime thing, wasn't
it? Yes, wonderful. Crown Court was on at lunchtime on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it had a real jury. The jury applied for tickets, and it was a court case. It was always in a courtroom. And it's back on again on legal TV or something.
Oh.
And you used to have to rehearse two endings, guilty and not guilty. And then the jury were given time to decide. And so it was quite a breakthrough in that sense. But the interesting thing about it was it had a lot of very good young writers were keen to do it. It was a great job. Immense rivalry between the defense and prosecution counsels. And the other interesting thing is that the actors who were playing the defendant always played it innocent. Apart from one, there's only one in the years I did it who admitted he was guilty. Everyone wanted to be innocent.
Right. And did most people get off?
Not if I was prosecutor. No, I was a defence counsel, which I liked much better.
That was the birth of reality television.
Well, it was in a way.
Yeah. It's your fault?
People were...
How much would it take to get you in the jungle now, then?
Oh, can you imagine?
No.
No.
You'd be searching through the poo for tapeworms again.
I'd be treating everyone.
You would?
Oh, they're tropical diseases.
Yeah. So no to that, then.
No to that. I mean, I am sort of toying with a reality program called Maestro.
What would you do?
I'd conduct an orchestra.
Ah. Oh, well, that's got, you know, that's a sort of talent to
but
that.
But I don't know. I'm very worried about it.
Yeah.
But I've always conducted orchestras.
In your bedroom?
In my bedroom.
Right.
Would you like to see a bit?
I would, actually, yeah.
Better than a bloody banjo, I tell you.
Well, I don't know, you might have been practicing, you might have kept it on the back burner all these years.
I'll never forgive you for that banjo. I think our friendship has just ceased.
Has it? The gloves are off. So, is it true that you turned down One Foot in the Grave three times before you said yes to it? Or is that a showbiz myth?
No, it's pretty true.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I mean, first of all, I thought I was too young.
Mm-hmm.
Victor was 60 and I was 55.
Right.
And I know it doesn't seem a big gap.
Yeah.
But I thought I was too young to play older people.
A young-looking 55, that was the problem.
And there were some things about the script I wasn't sure about. So I said no to it twice before I even met them. And then, of course, I met them. And I knew David Renwick, who wrote it so brilliantly, because I'd done a series with him. And he wrote it with me in mind, which is hardly a compliment, is it? But he didn't tell me that.
Yeah.
Eventually, Susie Belbin was a very persistent producer, got me into the office.
But it was quite a slow burner at first, wasn't it?
It was very slow. I mean, the extraordinary thing about Susie Belbin was she kept saying, just you wait, this'll work.
Because it was huge. I mean, Victor Meldrew's a cultural icon, isn't he? He's a shorthand.
I can't possibly answer that
question.
Well,
I'll tell you he is. I mean, it's a shorthand for grumpy old bloke, isn't it?
I never played him like that.
How did you play him?
I played him as a rather put upon member of society who had been shunned by the system. Mm.
It's a shame the public misinterpret you so badly. When did you realise it had sort of entered the public consciousness in that very everyday, ubiquitous way?
I suppose once that third series came out.
Did it creep up on you, or did it?
Well, it did. I mean, also, because of Only When I Laugh and Tutti Frutti, I had been recognised a little bit. Fortunately, I knew a little bit, unlike you, who just zoomed straight to megastardom.
Sure. But when I first met you, it was in 1995. We worked together at the National Theatre.
The National Theatre.
Indeed we did. I mean, then you were just about as famous as it's possible for a human being to be. I mean, absolutely everywhere we went, people were falling down with awe, weren't they? And it always seemed to me that you coped with that very graciously and very easily. Is that something you had to learn, or is that just instinct?
I don't know. I mean, I hope I behaved graciously. I mean, sometimes I don't.
But
I did a series with Leslie Crowther, and I always remember Leslie, if it was pouring with rain and there was a huge queue of autograph hunters at the stage door, because he was very famous for crackerjack, you would never, ever turn anyone away. He would also say, oh, no, that's not a good one, let me do it again. He was really wonderful with his audience, and I suppose that he was my mentor as far as that was concerned. And as I say, you know, I wasn't joking when I said I still have an inferiority complex. Mm. So being better known, shall we say, opened things up. Mm. And I suppose you speak to people who you would never have spoken to because I'd have been too shy.
Because, I mean, to the public at large, you're known and loved as a comic actor principally, I suppose, aren't you?
Yeah.
But within the profession, you're probably as known and loved as you talked about earlier, as a theatre director.
Well, I'm very happy with that idea.
Royal Exchange Manchester, you were an associate at the Royal Court, you've worked in the West End, the National Theatre, on Broadway. Which do you think you're better at?
I think I'm probably a better director.
Oh, really?
I only really direct new writing.
You do, that's your passion, isn't it? New plays.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think that's what theatre should be about. I mean, I don't understand why people want to go and see Ibsen 8 times, you won't go and see a new play.
Yeah.
And I think theatre is about the society we live in. I don't want to take a Shakespeare play and try and twist it round to saying something about Northern Ireland.
So if your friends were off to do a Shakespeare play... maybe quite soon... You wouldn't come and see it, or what?
No, if I had a friend, for example, who was going to play Hamlet...
Yeah, sure.
I would say that every young actor has to play Hamlet.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. I won't come and see it, no. that would be my great pleasure.
Well, let's hope you've got a friend who is going to do that. I'd say you have a joie de vivre about you, and you enjoy life, and you enjoy nice restaurants and good clothes and nice car. You've got a beautiful home. And is that, do you think that's a reaction to a slightly Spartan upbringing?
Yes, I suppose so. I do get very upset with myself, in a sense. I'm being on tour just now. I get very beady about the hotels I'm in, and I do want luxury, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But partly that is to do better work in the evenings. But I don't know where it comes from.
No.
And I'm a bit ashamed of it.
Well, you say that, but you are unfailingly generous with it as well, aren't you? I mean, you can't answer this, but you are known as one of the most generous people around. You're very giving with it, and you're very inclusive, and I had no idea that pink champagne existed until I met you. For instance.
Well, yes, it took me a while to realise that I think champagne existed as well.
Talking of champagne brings us to socialism.
Yes.
Because you've been a lifelong supporter of the Labour Party.
Yes.
And still are.
Still am.
Indeed. And that surely is a result of growing up in Greenock and growing up amongst the shipyards.
Absolutely. Yes. I joined the Labour Party many, many, many years ago simply because the gulf between the rich and the poor was too great as far as I was concerned. Mm. So when it comes to champagne socialism, I think everyone should have champagne.
Quite, absolutely.
Mind you, it's a bit overrated, but there we are.
But pink stuff's very nice. Yeah. Now, you've had many accolades over the years, a couple of BAFTAs. Mm. You've got an OBE.
Mm.
But I don't think you've ever been rendered in plastic. But because you had, frankly, the temerity to be in a show called Doctor Who before me, they've now produced a plastic figure of you.
Good heavens.
Which I thought I'd bring and show you. Look, here's a little mini you. What do you think? This is great radio, isn't it?
My goodness.
That's you. There's a little 5-inch plastic Richard Wilson dressed as a doctor. You're in a doctor's coat, like all those years ago.
Actually, it's not a bad likeness, is it? Oh, it's taking me right back.
This is the best bit. You can pull his head off. It comes with another head. And you've turned into a gas mask zombie, look!
My goodness.
There you go. Yeah. If you fall on hard times, you can sign that, shove it on eBay. Keep the pink champagne flowing.
Well, that's extraordinary. Thank you very much for bringing that to my attention.
Wow.
I'll just play with myself.
So finally, Richard, when the Richard Wilson biopic is made, From Greenock to the Grave, or I don't know, we can argue over the title, but will you be in it or will you be directing it?
I'll be doing neither. Oh, I couldn't imagine it.
No?
No. No.
So you'll be picketing the cinema to stop people going to see it? Well,
I did stop my This Is Your Life.
Right.
I did put the kibosh in that. But I found out... That's rather a silly question, if you don't mind. I mean, to finish with, would I be in it? How could I be in it, David?
It's a choice. It's an either or. Don't deconstruct the question. Just play along. I'm trying to finish on a flourish.
Oh.
Look, you didn't do this to Parkinson.
All right. I won't be grumpy about it then. I'll direct it.
And who will play you?
Well, I think you should.
Okay. If I play you, do I have to shave my head?
No.
Because you do cherish your privacy. You didn't want to do This as your life. Is there something about being an actor that's about keeping something back, do you think?
Well, I always think that I don't want people to know a lot about me because I want to be able to fool them.
Mm.
I can't understand actors who want to talk about their orgasms in public. Mm.
Or even occasionally have public orgasms.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I always thought that This Is Your Life was a bit of an artificial thing. And yes, it was an obvious way of seeing into you.
Mm.
Just like this program.
Do you regret doing this program for the same reason?
It's been an absolute joy.
Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Wilson.
Well, follow that. David Tennant was interviewing Richard Wilson. The producer was Talusha Gilani. Next week, Richard Wilson interviews Arabella Weir. Stand by for Shockwaves in the Bull. It's the Archers after the news.
Z equals X plus Y, where X is delusions of uniqueness, Y is poetic tendencies, and Z is imbecile. So you're an imbecile, Charlie.
Hey.
Brand new comedy sci-fi on BBC Seven.
You will learn the error of your ways from the ship's brig.
I'm not a brig.
Yes, it's next to the laundry room.
There's a laundry room?
Featuring Dan Tetzel and Prunella Scales.
Now go wash your hands, boys. It's dinner time.
Space Hacks Series 2.
It's the little people in the toilet. They're talking.
Starts Saturday night at 6 p.m. and midnight on BBC Seven.
This is Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. It's been confirmed.